Chapter 12. However, there is a much more serious difficulty than the local and temporary objections which I discussed in the last chapter. Faced by the fact that intelligent people are so often on the other side, the socialist is apt to set it down to corrupt motives, conscious or unconscious, or to an ignorant belief that socialism would not work. Or to a mere dread of the horrors and discomforts of the revolutionary period before socialism is established. Undoubtedly, all these are important, but there are plenty of people who are influenced by none of them and are nevertheless hostile to socialism. Their reason for recoiling from socialism is spiritual, or ideological. They object to it not on the ground that it would not work, but precisely because it would work too well. What they are afraid of is not the things that are going to happen in their own lifetime, but the things that are going to happen in the remote future when socialism is a reality. I have very seldom met a convinced socialist who could grasp that thinking people may be repelled by the objective towards which socialism appears to be moving. The Marxist, especially, dismisses this kind of thing as bourgeois sentimentality. Marxists as a rule are not very good at reading the minds of their adversaries. If they were, the situation in Europe might be less desperate than it is at present. Possessing a technique which seems to explain everything, they do not often bother to discover what is going on inside other people's heads. Here, for instance, is an illustration of the kind of thing I mean. Discussing the widely held theory, which in one sense is certainly true, that fascism is a product of communism, Mr. N. Holdaway, one of the ablest Marxist writers we possess, writes as follows. The hoary legend of communism leading to fascism. The element of truth in it is this: that the appearance of communist activity warns the ruling class that democratic labor parties are no longer capable of holding the working class in check. And that capitalist dictatorship must assume another form if it is to survive. You see here the defects of the method. Because he has detected the underlying economic cause of fascism, he tacitly assumes that the spiritual side of it is of no importance. Fascism is written off as a maneuver of the ruling class, which at bottom it is. But this in itself would only explain why fascism appeals to capitalists. What about the millions who are not capitalists, who in a material sense have nothing to gain from fascism and are often aware of it, and who, nevertheless, are fascists? Obviously, their approach has been purely along the ideological line. They could only be stampeded into fascism because communism attacked or seemed to attack certain things, patriotism, religion, etc., which lay deeper than the economic motive, and in that sense it is perfectly true that communism leads to fascism. It is a pity that Marxists nearly always concentrate on letting economic cats out of ideological bags. It does in one sense reveal the truth, but with this penalty, that most of their propaganda misses its mark. It is the spiritual recoil from socialism, especially as it manifests itself in sensitive people, that I want to discuss in this chapter. I shall have to analyze it at some length, because it is very widespread, very powerful and, among socialists, almost completely ignored. The first thing to notice is that the idea of socialism is bound up, more or less inextricably, with the idea of machine production. Socialism is essentially an urban creed. It grew up more or less concurrently with industrialism. It has always had its roots in the town proletariat and the town intellectual, and it is doubtful whether it could ever have arisen in any but an industrial society. Granted industrialism, the idea of socialism presents itself naturally, because private ownership is only tolerable when every individual, or family or other unit, is at least moderately self-supporting. But the effect of industrialism is to make it impossible for anyone to be self-supporting even for a moment. Industrialism, once it rises above a fairly low level, must lead to some form of collectivism. Not necessarily to socialism, of course. Conceivably it might lead to the slave state of which fascism is a kind of prophecy. And the converse is also true. Machine production suggests socialism, but socialism as a world system implies machine production, because it demands certain things not compatible with a primitive way of life. It demands, for instance, constant intercommunication and exchange of goods between all parts of the earth. It demands some degree of centralized control. It demands an approximately equal standard of life for all human beings and probably a certain uniformity of education. We may take it, therefore, that any world in which socialism was a reality would be at least as highly mechanized as the United States at this moment, probably much more so. In any case, no socialist would think of denying this. The socialist world is always pictured as a completely mechanized, immensely organized world, depending on the machine as the civilizations of antiquity depended on the slave. So far so good, or so bad. Many, perhaps a majority, of thinking people are not in love with machine civilization, but everyone who is not a fool knows that it is nonsense to talk at this moment about scrapping the machine. But the unfortunate thing is that socialism, as usually presented, is bound up with the idea of mechanical progress, not merely as a necessary development but as an end in itself, almost as a kind of religion. This idea is implicit in, for instance, most of the propagandist stuff that is written about the rapid mechanical advance in Soviet Russia, the Dnieper Dam, tractors, etc. etc. Karel Capek hits it off well enough in the horrible ending of RUR, when the robots, having slaughtered the last human being, announce their intention to build many houses, just for the sake of building houses. You see, the kind of person who most readily accepts socialism is also the kind of person who views mechanical progress, as such, with enthusiasm. And this is so much the case that socialists are often unable to grasp that the opposite opinion exists. As a rule, the most persuasive argument they can think of is to tell you that the present mechanization of the world is as nothing to what we shall see when socialism is established. Where there is one aeroplane now, in those days there will be 50. All the work that is now done by hand will then be done by machinery, everything that is now made of leather, wood or stone will be made of rubber, glass or steel, there will be no disorder, no loose ends. No wildernesses, no wild animals, no weeds, no disease, no poverty, no pain, and so on and so forth. The socialist world is to be above all things an ordered world. An efficient world. But it is precisely from that vision of the future as a sort of glittering Wells world that sensitive minds recoil. Please notice that this essentially fat-bellied version of progress is not an integral part of socialist doctrine, but it has come to be thought of as one. With the result that the temperamental conservatism which is latent in all kinds of people is easily mobilized against socialism. Every sensitive person has moments when he is suspicious of machinery and to some extent of physical science. But it is important to sort out the various motives, which have differed greatly at different times, for hostility to science and machinery. And to disregard the jealousy of the modern literary gent who hates science because science has stolen literature's thunder. The earliest full-length attack on science and machinery that I am acquainted with is in the third part of Gulliver's Travels. But Swift's attack, though brilliant as a tour de force, is irrelevant and even silly, because it is written from the standpoint, perhaps this seems a queer thing to say of the author of Gulliver's Travels, of a man who lacked imagination. To Swift, science was merely a kind of futile muckraking and the machines were nonsensical contraptions that would never work. His standard was that of practical usefulness, and he lacked the vision to see that an experiment which is not demonstrably useful at the moment may yield results in the future. Elsewhere in the book he names it as the best of all achievements to make two blades of grass grow where one grew before, not seeing, apparently, that this is just what the machine can do. A little later the despised machines began working, physical science increased its scope, and there came the celebrated conflict between religion and science which agitated our grandfathers. That conflict is over and both sides have retreated and claimed a victory, but an anti-scientific bias still lingers in the minds of most religious believers. All through the 19th century protesting voices were raised against science and machinery, see Dickens's Hard Times, for instance, but usually for the rather shallow reason that industrialism in its first stages was cruel and ugly. Samuel Butler's attack on the machine in the well-known chapter of Erewhon is a different matter. But Butler himself lived in a less desperate age than our own, an age in which it was still possible for a first-rate man to be a dilettante part of the time, and therefore the whole thing appeared to him as a kind of intellectual exercise. He saw clearly enough our abject dependence on the machine, but instead of bothering to work out its consequences, he preferred to exaggerate it for the sake of what was not much more than a joke. It is only in our own age, when mechanization has finally triumphed, that we can actually feel the tendency of the machine to make a fully human life impossible. There is probably no one capable of thinking and feeling who has not occasionally looked at a gaspipe chair and reflected that the machine is the enemy of life. As a rule, however, this feeling is instinctive rather than reasoned. People know that in some way or another progress is a swindle, but they reach this conclusion by a kind of mental shorthand. My job here is to supply the logical steps that are usually left out. But first one must ask, what is the function of the machine? Obviously its primary function is to save work, and the type of person to whom machine civilization is entirely acceptable seldom sees any reason for looking further. Here for instance is a person who claims, or rather screams, that he is thoroughly at home in the modern mechanized world. I am quoting from World Without Faith, by Mr. John Beavers. This is what he says. It is plain lunacy to say that the average 2 pounds, tens, to 4 pounds a week man of today is a lower type than an 18th century farm laborer. Or than the laborer or peasant of any exclusively agricultural community now or in the past. It just isn't true. It is so damn silly to cry out about the civilizing effects of work in the fields and farmyards as against that done in a big locomotive works or an automobile factory. Work is a nuisance. We work because we have to, and all work is done to provide us with leisure and the means of spending that leisure as enjoyably as possible. And again, man is going to have time enough and power enough to hunt for his own heaven on earth without worrying about the supernatural one. The earth will be so pleasant a place that the priest and the parson won't be left with much of a tale to tell. Half the stuffing is knocked out of them by one neat blow. Etc., etc., etc. There is a whole chapter to this effect, chapter 4 of Mr. Beavers's book, and it is of some interest as an exhibition of machine worship in its most completely vulgar, ignorant and half-baked form. It is the authentic voice of a large section of the modern world. Every aspirin eater in the outer suburbs would echo it fervently. Notice the shrill wail of anger, "It just isn't true," etc. with which Mr. Beavers meets the suggestion that his grandfather may have been a better man than himself, and the still more horrible suggestion that if we return to a simpler way of life he might have to toughen his muscles with a job of work. Work, you see, is done to provide us with leisure. Leisure for what? Leisure to become more like Mr. Beavers, presumably. Though as a matter of fact, from that line of talk about heaven on earth, you can make a fairly good guess at what he would like civilization to be. A sort of lion's corner house lasting in secula seculorum and getting bigger and noisier all the time. And in any book by anyone who feels at home in the machine world, in any book by H.G. Wells, for instance, you will find passages of the same kind. How often have we not heard it, that gluttonously uplifting stuff about the machines, our new race of slaves, which will set humanity free, etc., etc., etc. To these people, apparently, the only danger of the machine is its possible use for destructive purposes, as, for instance, aeroplanes are used in war. Barring wars and unforeseen disasters, the future is envisaged as an ever more rapid march of mechanical progress. Machines to save work, machines to save thought, machines to save pain, hygiene, efficiency, organization, more hygiene, more efficiency, more organization, more machines, until finally you land up in the by now familiar Wellesian utopia. Aptly caricatured by Huxley in Brave New World, the paradise of little fat men. Of course in their daydreams of the future the little fat men are neither fat nor little, they are men like gods. But why should they be? All mechanical progress is towards greater and greater efficiency. Ultimately, therefore, towards a world in which nothing goes wrong. But in a world in which nothing went wrong, many of the qualities which Mr. Wells regards as godlike would be no more valuable than the animal faculty of moving the ears. The beings in men like gods in the dream are represented, for example, as brave, generous and physically strong. But in a world from which physical danger had been banished, and obviously mechanical progress tends to eliminate danger, would physical courage be likely to survive? Could it survive? And why should physical strength survive in a world where there was never the need for physical labor? As for such qualities as loyalty, generosity, etc. In a world where nothing went wrong, they would be not only irrelevant but probably unimaginable. The truth is that many of the qualities we admire in human beings can only function in opposition to some kind of disaster, pain or difficulty. But the tendency of mechanical progress is to eliminate disaster, pain and difficulty. In books like The Dream and Men Like Gods, it is assumed that such qualities as strength, courage, generosity, etc. will be kept alive because they are comely qualities and necessary attributes of a full human being. Presumably, for instance, the inhabitants of Utopia would create artificial dangers in order to exercise their courage, and do dumbbell exercises to harden muscles which they would never be obliged to use. And here you observe the huge contradiction which is usually present in the idea of progress. The tendency of mechanical progress is to make your environment safe and soft, and yet you are striving to keep yourself brave and hard. You are at the same moment furiously pressing forward and desperately holding back. It is as though a London stockbroker should go to his office in a suit of chain mail and insist on talking medieval Latin. So in the last analysis, the champion of progress is also the champion of anachronisms. Meanwhile, I am assuming that the tendency of mechanical progress is to make life safe and soft. This may be disputed, because at any given moment the effect of some recent mechanical invention may appear to be the opposite. Take for instance the transition from horses to motor vehicles. At a first glance one might say, considering the enormous toll of road deaths, that the motor car does not exactly tend to make life safer. Moreover, it probably needs as much toughness to be a first-rate dirt track rider as to be a Bronco Buster or to ride in the Grand National. Nevertheless, the tendency of all machinery is to become safer and easier to handle. The danger of accidents would disappear if we chose to tackle our road planning problem seriously, as we shall do sooner or later. And meanwhile, the motor car has evolved to a point at which anyone who is not blind or paralytic can drive it after a few lessons. Even now it needs far less nerve and skill to drive a car ordinarily well than to ride a horse ordinarily well. In 20 years' time it may need no nerve or skill at all. Therefore, one must say that, taking society as a whole, the result of the transition from horses to cars has been an increase in human softness. Presently somebody comes along with another invention, the aeroplane for instance, which does not at first sight appear to make life safer. The first men who went up in aeroplanes were superlatively brave, and even today it must need an exceptionally good nerve to be a pilot. But the same tendency as before is at work. The aeroplane, like the motor car, will be made foolproof. A million engineers are working, almost unconsciously, in that direction. Finally, this is the objective, though it may never quite be reached. You will get an aeroplane whose pilot needs no more skill or courage than a baby needs in its perambulator. And all mechanical progress is and must be in this direction. A machine evolves by becoming more efficient, that is, more foolproof. Hence the objective of mechanical progress is a foolproof world, which may or may not mean a world inhabited by fools. Mr. Wells would probably retort that the world can never become foolproof, because, however high a standard of efficiency you have reached, there is always some greater difficulty ahead. For example, this is Mr. Wells's favorite idea, he has used it in goodness knows how many perorations. When you have got this planet of ours perfectly into trim, you start upon the enormous task of reaching and colonizing another. But this is merely to push the objective further into the fixture, the objective itself remains the same. Colonize another planet, and the game of mechanical progress begins anew. For the foolproof world you have substituted the foolproof solar system, the foolproof universe. In tying yourself to the ideal of mechanical efficiency, you tie yourself to the ideal of softness. But softness is repulsive. And thus all progress is seen to be a frantic struggle towards an objective which you hope and pray will never be reached. Now and again, but not often, you meet somebody who grasps that what is usually called progress also entails what is usually called degeneracy, and who is nevertheless in favor of progress. Hence the fact that in Mr. Shaw's utopia a statue was erected to Falstaff, as the first man who ever made a speech in favor of cowardice. But the trouble goes immensely deeper than this. Hitherto I have only pointed out the absurdity of aiming at mechanical progress and also at the preservation of qualities which mechanical progress makes unnecessary. The question one has got to consider is whether there is any human activity which would not be maimed by the dominance of the machine. The function of the machine is to save work. In a fully mechanized world, all the dull drudgery will be done by machinery, leaving us free for more interesting pursuits. So expressed, this sounds splendid. It makes one sick to see half a dozen men sweating their guts out to dig a trench for a water pipe, when some easily devised machine would scoop the earth out in a couple of minutes. Why not let the machine do the work and the men go and do something else? But presently the question arises, what else are they to do? Supposedly they are set free from work in order that they may do something which is not work. But what is work and what is not work? Is it work to dig, to carpenter, to plant trees, to fell trees, to ride, to fish, to hunt, to feed chickens, to play the piano, to take photographs, to build a house, to cook, to sew, to trim hats, to mend motorbicycles? All of these things are work to somebody, and all of them are play to somebody. There are in fact very few activities which cannot be classed either as work or play according as you choose to regard them. The laborer set free from digging may want to spend his leisure, or part of it, in playing the piano, while the professional pianist may be only too glad to get out and dig at the potato patch. Hence the antithesis between work, as something intolerably tedious, and not work, as something desirable, is false. The truth is that when a human being is not eating, drinking, sleeping, making love, talking, playing games or merely lounging about, and these things will not fill up a lifetime, he needs work and usually looks for it, though he may not call it work. Above the level of a third or fourth grade moron, life has got to be lived largely in terms of effort. For man is not, as the vulgar hedonists seem to suppose, a kind of walking stomach, he has also got a hand, an eye, and a brain. Cease to use your hands, and you have lopped off a huge chunk of your consciousness. And now consider again those half-dozen men who were digging the trench for the water pipe. A machine has set them free from digging, and they are going to amuse themselves with something else, carpentering, for instance. But whatever they want to do, they will find that another machine has set them free from that. For in a fully mechanized world there would be no more need to carpenter, to cook, to mend motor bicycles, etc., than there would be to dig. There is scarcely anything, from catching a whale to carving a cherry stone, that could not conceivably be done by machinery. The machine would even encroach upon the activities we now class as art. It is doing so already, via the camera and the radio. Mechanize the world as fully as it might be mechanized, and whichever way you turn there will be some machine cutting you off from the chance of working, that is, of living. At a first glance this might not seem to matter. Why should you not get on with your creative work and disregard the machines that would do it for you? But it is not so simple as it sounds. Here am I, working 8 hours a day in an insurance office. In my spare time I want to do something creative, so I choose to do a bit of carpentering, to make myself a table, for instance. Notice that from the very start there is a touch of artificiality about the whole business, for the factories can turn me out a far better table than I can make for myself. But even when I get to work on my table, it is not possible for me to feel towards it as the cabinet maker of 100 years ago felt towards his table, still less as Robinson Crusoe felt towards his. For before I start, most of the work has already been done for me by machinery. The tools I use demand the minimum of skill. I can get, for instance, planes which will cut out any molding. The cabinet maker of 100 years ago would have had to do the work with chisel and gouge, which demanded real skill of eye and hand. The boards I buy are ready planed and the legs are ready turned by the lathe. I can even go to the wood shop and buy all the parts of the table ready-made and only needing to be fitted together, my work being reduced to driving in a few pegs and using a piece of sandpaper. And if this is so at present, in the mechanized future it will be enormously more so. With the tools and materials available then, there will be no possibility of mistake, hence no room for skill. Making a table will be easier and duller than peeling a potato. In such circumstances it is nonsense to talk of creative work. In any case the arts of the hand, which have got to be transmitted by apprenticeship, would long since have disappeared. Some of them have disappeared already, under the competition of the machine. Look round any country churchyard and see whether you can find a decently cut tombstone later than 1820. The art, or rather the craft, of stonework has died out so completely that it would take centuries to revive it. But it may be said, why not retain the machine and retain creative work? Why not cultivate anachronisms as a spare time hobby? Many people have played with this idea, it seems to solve with such beautiful ease the problems set by the machine. The citizen of Utopia, we are told, coming home from his daily 2 hours of turning a handle in the tomato canning factory, will deliberately revert to a more primitive way of life and solace his creative instincts with a bit of fretwork. Pottery glazing or handloom weaving. And why is this picture an absurdity? As it is, of course. Because of a principle that is not always recognized, though always acted upon, that so long as the machine is there, one is under an obligation to use it. No one draws water from the well when he can turn on the tap. One sees a good illustration of this in the matter of travel. Everyone who has traveled by primitive methods in an undeveloped country knows that the difference between that kind of travel and modern travel in trains, cars, etc., is the difference between life and death. The nomad who walks or rides, with his baggage stowed on a camel or an ox cart, may suffer every kind of discomfort, but at least he is living while he is traveling. Whereas for the passenger in an express train or a luxury liner his journey is an interregnum, a kind of temporary death. And yet so long as the railways exist, one has got to travel by train, or by car or aeroplane. Here am I, 40 miles from London. When I want to go up to London, why do I not pack my luggage onto a mule and set out on foot, making a 2 days' march of it? Because, with the Green Line buses whizzing past me every 10 minutes, such a journey would be intolerably irksome. In order that one may enjoy primitive methods of travel, it is necessary that no other method should be available. No human being ever wants to do anything in a more cumbrous way than is necessary. Hence the absurdity of that picture of utopians saving their souls with fretwork. In a world where everything could be done by machinery, everything would be done by machinery. Deliberately to revert to primitive methods, to use archaic tools, to put silly little difficulties in your own way, would be a piece of dilettanteism, of pretty arty and craftiness. It would be like solemnly sitting down to eat your dinner with stone implements. Revert to handwork in a machine age, and you are back in ye old tea shop or the Tudor villa with the sham beams tacked to the wall. The tendency of mechanical progress, then, is to frustrate the human need for effort and creation. It makes unnecessary and even impossible the activities of the eye and the hand. The apostle of progress will sometimes declare that this does not matter, but you can usually drive him into a corner by pointing out the horrible lengths to which the process can be carried. Why, for instance, use your hands at all? Why use them even for blowing your nose or sharpening a pencil? Surely you could fix some kind of steel and rubber contraption to your shoulders and let your arms wither into stumps of skin and bone. And so with every organ and every faculty. There is really no reason why a human being should do more than eat, drink, sleep, breathe and procreate. Everything else could be done for him by machinery. Therefore the logical end of mechanical progress is to reduce the human being to something resembling a brain in a bottle. That is the goal towards which we are already moving, though, of course, we have no intention of getting there. Just as a man who drinks a bottle of whiskey a day does not actually intend to get cirrhosis of the liver. The implied objective of progress is, not exactly, perhaps, the brain in the bottle, but at any rate some frightful subhuman depth of softness and helplessness. And the unfortunate thing is that at present the word progress and the word socialism are linked inseparably in almost everyone's mind. The kind of person who hates machinery also takes it for granted to hate socialism. The socialist is always in favor of mechanization, rationalization, modernization, or at least thinks that he ought to be in favor of them. Quite recently, for instance, a prominent ILPer confessed to me with a sort of wistful shame, as though it were something faintly improper, that he was fond of horses. Horses, you see, belong to the vanished agricultural past, and all sentiment for the past carries with it a vague smell of heresy. I do not believe that this need necessarily be so, but undoubtedly it is so. And in itself it is quite enough to explain the alienation of decent minds from socialism. A generation ago every intelligent person was in some sense a revolutionary. Nowadays it would be nearer the mark to say that every intelligent person is a reactionary. In this connection it is worth comparing H.G. Wells's The Sleeper Awakes with Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, written 30 years later. Each is a pessimistic utopia, a vision of a sort of prig's paradise in which all the dreams of the progressive person come true. Considered merely as a piece of imaginative construction, The Sleeper Awakes is, I think, much superior, but it suffers from vast contradictions because of the fact that Wells, as the arch-priest of progress, cannot write with any conviction against progress. He draws a picture of a glittering, strangely sinister world in which the privileged classes live a life of shallow gutless hedonism, and the workers, reduced to a state of utter slavery and subhuman ignorance, toil like troglodytes in caverns underground. As soon as one examines this idea, it is further developed in a splendid short story in Stories of Space and Time, one sees its inconsistency. For in the immensely mechanized world that Wells is imagining, why should the workers have to work harder than at present? Obviously, the tendency of the machine is to eliminate work, not to increase it. In the machine world, the workers might be enslaved, ill-treated, and even underfed, but they certainly would not be condemned to ceaseless manual toil, because in that case, what would be the function of the machine? You can have machines doing all the work or human beings doing all the work, but you can't have both. Those armies of underground workers, with their blue uniforms and their debased, half-human language, are only put in to make your flesh creep. Wells wants to suggest that progress might take a wrong turning, but the only evil he cares to imagine is inequality, one class grabbing all the wealth and power and oppressing the others, apparently out of pure spite. Give it quite a small twist, he seems to suggest, overthrow the privileged class, change over from world capitalism to socialism, in fact, and all will be well. The machine civilization is to continue, but its products are to be shared out equally. The thought he dare not face is that the machine itself may be the enemy. So in his more characteristic utopias, The Dream, Men Like Gods, etc., he returns to optimism and to a vision of humanity, liberated, by the machine, as a race of enlightened sunbathers whose sole topic of conversation is their own superiority to their ancestors. Brave New World belongs to a later time and to a generation which has seen through the swindle of progress. It contains its own contradictions, the most important of them is pointed out in Mr. John Strachey's The Coming Struggle for Power, but it is at least a memorable assault on the more fat-bellied type of perfectionism. Allowing for the exaggerations of caricature, it probably expresses what a majority of thinking people feel about machine civilization. The sensitive person's hostility to the machine is in one sense unrealistic, because of the obvious fact that the machine has come to stay. But as an attitude of mind, there is a great deal to be said for it. The machine has got to be accepted, but it is probably better to accept it rather as one accepts a drug, that is, grudgingly and suspiciously. Like a drug, the machine is useful, dangerous, and habit-forming. The oftener one surrenders to it, the tighter its grip becomes. You have only to look about you at this moment to realize with what sinister speed the machine is getting us into its power. To begin with, there is the frightful debauchery of taste that has already been effected by a century of mechanization. This is almost too obvious and too generally admitted to need pointing out. But as a single instance, take taste in its narrowest sense, the taste for decent food. In the highly mechanized countries, thanks to tinned food, cold storage, synthetic flavoring matters, etc., the palate is almost a dead organ. As you can see by looking at any greengrocer's shop, what the majority of English people mean by an apple is a lump of highly colored cotton wool from America or Australia. They will devour these things, apparently with pleasure, and let the English apples rot under the trees. It is the shiny, standardized, machine-made look of the American apple that appeals to them. The superior taste of the English apple is something they simply do not notice. Or look at the factory-made, foil-wrapped cheeses and blended butter in any grocers. Look at the hideous rows of tins which usurp more and more of the space in any food shop, even a dairy. Look at a sixpenny Swiss roll or a twopenny ice cream. Look at the filthy chemical byproduct that people will pour down their throats under the name of beer. Wherever you look, you will see some slick machine-made article triumphing over the old-fashioned article that still tastes of something other than sawdust. And what applies to food applies also to furniture, houses, clothes, books, amusements, and everything else that makes up our environment. There are now millions of people, and they are increasing every year, to whom the blaring of a radio is not only a more acceptable but a more normal background to their thoughts than the lowing of cattle or the song of birds. The mechanization of the world could never proceed very far while taste, even the taste buds of the tongue, remained uncorrupted, because in that case most of the products of the machine would be simply unwanted. In a healthy world there would be no demand for tinned food, aspirins, gramophones, gas pipe chairs, machine guns, daily newspapers, telephones, motor cars, etc., etc. And on the other hand there would be a constant demand for the things the machine cannot produce. But meanwhile the machine is here, and its corrupting effects are almost irresistible. One inveighs against it, but one goes on using it. Even a bear-ass savage, given the chance, will learn the vices of civilization within a few months. Mechanization leads to the decay of taste, the decay of taste leads to the demand for machine-made articles and hence to more mechanization, and so a vicious circle is established. But in addition to this there is a tendency for the mechanization of the world to proceed as it were automatically, whether we want it or not. This is due to the fact that in modern Western man the faculty of mechanical invention has been fed and stimulated till it has reached almost the status of an instinct. People invent new machines and improve existing ones almost unconsciously, rather as a somnambulist will go on working in his sleep. In the past, when it was taken for granted that life on this planet is harsh or at any rate laborious, it seemed the natural fate to go on using the clumsy implements of your forefathers, and only a few eccentric persons, centuries apart. Proposed innovations. Hence throughout enormous ages such things as the ox cart, the plow, the sickle, etc., remained radically unchanged. It is on record that screws have been in use since remote antiquity and yet that it was not till the middle of the 19th century that anyone thought of making screws with points on them. For several thousand years they remained flat-ended and holes had to be drilled for them before they could be inserted. In our own epoch such a thing would be unthinkable. For almost every modern Western man has his inventive faculty to some extent developed. The Western man invents machines as naturally as the Polynesian islander swims. Give a Western man a job of work and he immediately begins devising a machine that would do it for him, give him a machine and he thinks of ways of improving it. I understand this tendency well enough, for in an ineffectual sort of way I have that type of mind myself. I have not either the patience or the mechanical skill to devise any machine that would work, but I am perpetually seeing, as it were, the ghosts of possible machines that might save me the trouble of using my brain or muscles. A person with a more definite mechanical turn would probably construct some of them and put them into operation. But under our present economic system, whether he constructed them, or rather, whether anyone else had the benefit of them, would depend upon whether they were commercially valuable. The socialists are right, therefore, when they claim that the rate of mechanical progress will be much more rapid once socialism is established. Given a mechanical civilization, the process of invention and improvement will always continue, but the tendency of capitalism is to slow it down, because under capitalism any invention which does not promise fairly immediate profits is neglected. Some, indeed, which threaten to reduce profits are suppressed almost as ruthlessly as the flexible glass mentioned by Petronius. 6. Establish socialism, remove the profit principle, and the inventor will have a free hand. The mechanization of the world, already rapid enough, would be, or at any rate could be, enormously accelerated. And this prospect is a slightly sinister one, because it is obvious even now that the process of mechanization is out of control. It is happening merely because humanity has got the habit. A chemist perfects a new method of synthesizing rubber, or a mechanic devises a new pattern of gudgeon pin. Why? Not for any clearly understood purpose, but simply from the impulse to invent and improve, which has now become instinctive. Put a pacifist to work in a bomb factory, and in 2 months he will be devising a new type of bomb. Hence the appearance of such diabolical things as poison gases, which are not expected even by their inventors to be beneficial to humanity. Our attitude toward such things as poison gases ought to be the attitude of the king of Brobdingnag towards gunpowder. But because we live in a mechanical and scientific age, we are infected with the notion that, whatever else happens, progress must continue and knowledge must never be suppressed. Verbally, no doubt, we would agree that machinery is made for man and not man for machinery. In practice, any attempt to check the development of the machine appears to us as an attack on knowledge and therefore a kind of blasphemy. And even if the whole of humanity suddenly revolted against the machine and decided to escape to a simpler way of life, the escape would still be immensely difficult. It would not do, as in Butler's Erewhon, to smash every machine invented after a certain date. We should also have to smash the habit of mind that would, almost involuntarily, devise fresh machines as soon as the old ones were smashed. And in all of us there is at least a tinge of that habit of mind. In every country in the world, the large army of scientists and technicians, with the rest of us panting at their heels, is marching along the road of progress with the blind persistence of a column of ants. Comparatively few people want it to happen, plenty of people actively want it not to happen, and yet it is happening. The process of mechanization has itself become a machine, a huge glittering vehicle whirling us we are not certain where, but probably towards the padded Wells world and the brain in the bottle. This, then, is the case against the machine. Whether it is a sound or unsound case hardly matters. The point is that these or very similar arguments would be echoed by every person who is hostile to machine civilization. And unfortunately, because of that nexus of thought, socialism progress machinery rush attractors hygiene machinery progress, which exists in almost everyone's mind, it is usually the same person who is hostile to socialism. The kind of person who hates central heating and gas pipe chairs is also the kind of person who, when you mention socialism, murmurs something about beehive state and moves away with a pained expression. So far as my observation goes, very few socialists grasp why this is so, or even that it is so. Get the more vocal type of socialist into a corner, repeat to him the substance of what I have said in this chapter, and see what kind of answer you get. As a matter of fact, you will get several answers. I am so familiar with them that I know them almost by heart. In the first place, he will tell you that it is impossible to go back, or to put back the hand of progress, as though the hand of progress hadn't been pretty violently put back several times in human history. And will then accuse you of being a medievalist and begin to descant upon the horrors of the Middle Ages, leprosy, the Inquisition, etc. As a matter of fact, most attacks upon the Middle Ages and the past generally by apologists of modernity are beside the point, because their essential trick is to project a modern man, with his squeamishness and his high standards of comfort, into an age when such things were unheard of. But notice that in any case this is not an answer. For a dislike of the mechanized future does not imply the smallest reverence for any period of the past. D. H. Lawrence, wiser than the medievalist, chose to idealize the Etruscans, about whom we know conveniently little. But there is no need to idealize even the Etruscans, or the Pelasgians, or the Aztecs, or the Sumerians, or any other vanished and romantic people. When one pictures a desirable civilization, one pictures it merely as an objective. There is no need to pretend that it has ever existed in space and time. Press this point home, explain that you wish merely to aim at making life simpler and harder instead of softer and more complex. And the socialist will usually assume that you want to revert to a state of nature, meaning some stinking Paleolithic cave, as though there were nothing between a flint scraper and the steel mills of Sheffield. Or between a skin coracle and the Queen Mary. Finally, however, you will get an answer which is rather more to the point and which runs roughly as follows: yes, what you are saying is all very well in its way. No doubt it would be very noble to harden ourselves and do without aspirins and central heating and so forth. But the point is, you see, that nobody seriously wants it. It would mean going back to an agricultural way of life, which means beastly hard work and isn't at all the same thing as playing at gardening. I don't want hard work, you don't want hard work, nobody wants it, who knows what it means. You only talk as you do because you've never done a day's work in your life, etc., etc. Now this in a sense is true. It amounts to saying, we're soft, for God's sake let's stay soft, which at least is realistic. As I have pointed out already, the machine has got us in its grip and to escape will be immensely difficult. Nevertheless, this answer is really an evasion, because it fails to make clear what we mean when we say that we want this or that. I am a degenerate modern semi-intellectual who would die if I did not get my early morning cup of tea and my New Statesman every Friday. Clearly I do not, in a sense, want to return to a simpler, harder, probably agricultural way of life. In the same sense I don't want to cut down my drinking, to pay my debts, to take enough exercise, to be faithful to my wife, etc., etc. But in another and more permanent sense I do want these things, and perhaps in the same sense I want a civilization in which progress is not definable as making the world safe for little fat men. These that I have outlined are practically the only arguments that I have been able to get from socialists, thinking, book-trained socialists, when I have tried to explain to them just how they are driving away possible adherents. Of course there is also the old argument that socialism is going to arrive anyway, whether people like it or not, because of that trouble-saving thing, historic necessity. But historic necessity, or rather the belief in it, has failed to survive Hitler. Meanwhile, the thinking person, by intellect usually left-wing but by temperament often right-wing, hovers at the gate of the socialist fold. He is no doubt aware that he ought to be a socialist. But he observes first the dullness of individual socialists, then the apparent flabbiness of socialist ideals, and veers away. Till quite recently it was natural to veer towards indifferentism. 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, the typical literary gent wrote books on Baroque architecture and had a soul above politics. But that attitude is becoming difficult and even unfashionable. The times are growing harsher, the issues are clearer, the belief that nothing will ever change, i.e. that your dividends will always be safe, is less prevalent. The fence on which the literary gent sits, once as comfortable as the plush cushion of a cathedral stall, is now pinching his bottom intolerably, more and more he shows a disposition to drop off on one side or the other. It is interesting to notice how many of our leading writers, who a dozen years ago were art for art's sakeing for all they were worth and would have considered it too vulgar for words even to vote at a general election, are now taking a definite political standpoint. While most of the younger writers, at least those of them who are not mere footlers, have been political from the start. I believe that when the pinch comes there is a terrible danger that the main movement of the intelligentsia will be towards fascism. Just how soon the pinch will come it is difficult to say. It depends, probably, upon events in Europe. But it may be that within 2 years or even a year we shall have reached the decisive moment. That will also be the moment when every person with any brains or any decency will know in his bones that he ought to be on the socialist side. But he will not necessarily come there of his own accord, there are too many ancient prejudices standing in the way. He will have to be persuaded, and by methods that imply an understanding of his viewpoint. Socialists cannot afford to waste any more time in preaching to the converted. Their job now is to make socialists as rapidly as possible, instead of which, all too often, they are making fascists. When I speak of fascism in England, I am not necessarily thinking of Mosley and his pimpled followers. English fascism, when it arrives, is likely to be of a sedate and subtle kind, presumably, at any rate at first, it won't be called fascism. And it is doubtful whether a Gilbert and Sullivan heavy dragoon of Moseley's stamp would ever be much more than a joke to the majority of English people. Though even Moseley will bear watching, for experience shows, vide the careers of Hitler, Napoleon III, that to a political climber it is sometimes an advantage not to be taken too seriously at the beginning of his career. But what I am thinking of at this moment is the fascist attitude of mind, which beyond any doubt is gaining ground among people who ought to know better. Fascism as it appears in the intellectual is a sort of mirror image, not actually of socialism but of a plausible travesty of socialism. It boils down to a determination to do the opposite of whatever the mythical socialist does. If you present socialism in a bad and misleading light, if you let people imagine that it does not mean much more than pouring European civilization down the sink at the command of Marxist prigs, you risk driving the intellectual into fascism. You frighten him into a sort of angry defensive attitude in which he simply refuses to listen to the socialist case. Some such attitude is already quite clearly discernible in writers like Pound, Wyndham Lewis, Roy Campbell, etc. In most of the Roman Catholic writers and many of the Douglas Credit group, in certain popular novelists and even, if one looks below the surface, in superior conservative highbrows like Eliot and his countless followers. If you want some unmistakable illustrations of the growth of fascist feeling in England, have a look at some of the innumerable letters that were written to the press during the Abyssinian War, approving the Italian action. And also the howl of glee that went up from both Catholic and Anglican pulpits, see the Daily Mail of August 17, 1936, over the fascist rising in Spain. In order to combat fascism, it is necessary to understand it, which involves admitting that it contains some good as well as much evil. In practice, of course, it is merely an infamous tyranny, and its methods of attaining and holding power are such that even its most ardent apologists prefer to talk about something else. But the underlying feeling of fascism, the feeling that first draws people into the fascist camp, may be less contemptible. It is not always, as the Saturday Review would lead one to suppose, a squealing terror of the Bolshevik bogeyman. Everyone who has given the movement so much as a glance knows that the rank-and-file fascist is often quite a well-meaning person, quite genuinely anxious, for instance, to better the lot of the unemployed. But more important than this is the fact that fascism draws its strength from the good as well as the bad varieties of conservatism. To anyone with a feeling for tradition and for discipline, it comes with its appeal ready-made. Probably it is very easy, when you have had a bellyful of the more tactless kind of socialist propaganda, to see fascism as the last-line defense of all that is good in European civilization. Even the fascist bully at his symbolic worst, with rubber truncheon in one hand and castor oil bottle in the other, does not necessarily feel himself a bully. More probably he feels like Roland in the pass at Roncesvalles, defending Christendom against the barbarian. We have got to admit that if fascism is everywhere advancing, this is largely the fault of socialists themselves. Partly it is due to the mistaken communist tactic of sabotaging democracy, i.e. sawing off the branch you are sitting on, but still more to the fact that socialists have, so to speak, presented their case wrong side foremost. They have never made it sufficiently clear that the essential aims of socialism are justice and liberty. With their eyes glued to economic facts, they have proceeded on the assumption that man has no soul, and explicitly or implicitly they have set up the goal of a materialistic utopia. As a result, fascism has been able to play upon every instinct that revolts against hedonism and a cheap conception of progress. It has been able to pose as the upholder of the European tradition, and to appeal to Christian belief, to patriotism and to the military virtues. It is far worse than useless to write fascism off as mass sadism, or some easy phrase of that kind. If you pretend that it is merely an aberration which will presently pass off of its own accord, you are dreaming a dream from which you will awake when somebody cautions you with a rubber truncheon. The only possible course is to examine the fascist case, grasp that there is something to be said for it, and then make it clear to the world that whatever good fascism contains is also implicit in socialism. At present the situation is desperate. Even if nothing worse befalls us, there are the conditions which I described in the earlier part of this book and which are not going to improve under our present economic system. Still more urgent is the danger of fascist domination in Europe. And unless socialist doctrine, in an effective form, can be diffused widely and very quickly, there is no certainty that fascism will ever be overthrown. For socialism is the only real enemy that fascism has to face. The capitalist imperialist governments, even though they themselves are about to be plundered, will not fight with any conviction against fascism as such. Our rulers, those of them who understand the issue, would probably prefer to hand over every square inch of the British Empire to Italy, Germany, and Japan than to see socialism triumphant. It was easy to laugh at fascism when we imagined that it was based on hysterical nationalism, because it seemed obvious that the fascist states, each regarding itself as the chosen people and patriotic contra mundum, would clash with one another. But nothing of the kind is happening. Fascism is now an international movement, which means not only that the fascist nations can combine for purposes of loot, but that they are groping, perhaps only half-consciously as yet, towards a world system. For the vision of the totalitarian state there is being substituted the vision of the totalitarian world. As I pointed out earlier, the advance of machine technique must lead ultimately to some form of collectivism, but that form need not necessarily be equalitarian, that is, it need not be socialism. Pace the economists, it is quite easy to imagine a world society, economically collectivist, that is, with the profit principle eliminated, but with all political, military and educational power in the hands of a small caste of rulers and their bravos. That or something like it is the objective of fascism. And that, of course, is the slave state, or rather the slave world. It would probably be a stable form of society, and the chances are, considering the enormous wealth of the world if scientifically exploited, that the slaves would be well-fed and contented. It is usual to speak of the fascist objective as the beehive state, which does a grave injustice to bees. A world of rabbits ruled by stoats would be nearer the mark. It is against this beastly possibility that we have got to combine. The only thing for which we can combine is the underlying ideal of socialism, justice and liberty. But it is hardly strong enough to call this ideal underlying. It is almost completely forgotten. It has been buried beneath layer after layer of doctrinaire priggishness, party squabbles and half-baked progressivism, until it is like a diamond hidden under a mountain of dung. The job of the socialist is to get it out again. Justice and liberty. Those are the words that have got to ring like a bugle across the world. For a long time past, certainly for the last 10 years, the devil has had all the best tunes. We have reached a stage when the very word socialism calls up, on the one hand, a picture of aeroplanes, tractors and huge glittering factories of glass and concrete. On the other, a picture of vegetarians with wilting beards, of Bolshevik commissars, half gangster, half gramophone, of earnest ladies in sandals, shock-headed Marxists chewing polysyllables, escaped Quakers. Birth control fanatics and Labour Party backstairs crawlers. Socialism, at least in this island, does not smell any longer of revolution and the overthrow of tyrants, it smells of crankyishness, machine worship and the stupid cult of Russia. Unless you can remove that smell, and very rapidly, fascism may win.